that has these signs outside the doors that are open all day, every day. These doors are open for people of all faiths or none. And the resonance of all of this with that sign, like, I think a lot of people perceive the sign, and it's great however anybody wants to perceive it, obviously, but I think they think that it's... that it's a dualistic kind of thing, you know, those who are in and those who are out. What it's really saying is everyone's in. And that's also what I'm hearing in what Paul perceived in Acts and what Richard's writing about here, that that it isn't a matter of joining, it's a matter of being. And that God does not withhold God's self from anyone or anything. There is only Christ. Christ is everything. Christ is in everything. And then this pivotal concept that comes up repeatedly around Richard. I think do you all know Jeff Olson up in the Valley? There's a restaurant up there called Industrial Eats, and there's New West Catering. So Jeff says he's not doing something right if somebody does not complain about the Caesar salad. Like, every week, or preferably every day. Because it's a really knock-your-socks-off Caesar salad. So I think Richard probably feels like he's not doing his job if someone doesn't call him a pantheist. Anyhow, so he's not a pantheist. This is what he says: if I were to write that today, people would call me a pantheist. The universe is God, whereas I am really a panentheist. God lies within all things, but also transcends them, exactly like both Jesus and Paul. But that quote from Colossians, I think, is very much at the heart of things. And then, as you saw in the... in the chapter, this term en Christo, in Christ, Paul uses this phrase 164 times, which I kind of had a circuit through evangelicalism. I wasn't raised in it, but it became attractive at one point in my life, and I was always kind of amazed at how many sort of statistical and quoting different verses and so on that evangelicals could do and still can do. And, you know, I attempted a little bit of that and realized it was futile, so gave it up, all of it. And but, you know, things like this, you know, that Paul uses this phrase 164 times, I mean, it's kind of impressive in a way. And especially this phrase. So living inside a common identity. So once again, you know, we don't need to join up. And there isn't a Presbyterian way of being in Christ. There isn't a Baptist, Methodist, whatever way, Roman Catholic way of being in Christ. It's simply a common identity. And also includes, obviously, people who are none of those. So a participatory experience of salvation, humanity never separate from God. Living inside a cosmic identity, and then I love this over here, willingly or unwillingly, happily or unhappily, consciously or unconsciously, you know, it just is. And I am all of those things often. I mean, I'm definitely, you know, willing, unwilling, happy, unhappy, all of it. So further on that, living inside a common identity. And Richard notes in this chapter that this awareness is crucial for the future of Christianity. And we might reflect, maybe especially when we get to discussion time, why would that be true? But the identity that we're given is divine identity. And then Richard links it to the idea of a collective unconscious, which goes back to that, you know, morphic idea as well. So here's one of my favorite quotes from the chapter. every single creature, the teen mother nursing her child, every one of the 20,000 species of butterflies, an immigrant living in fear, a blade of grass, you reading this book are all in Christ and chosen from the beginning. And then, and this is one of the geniuses of Richard's teaching. He asks this question, what else could they be? I mean, what else could they be? And, you know, it's not an elaborate argument. It's just, could there be anything more obvious? But how has it not been obvious? And then this one, I have never been separate from God, nor can I be, except in my mind. I would love for you to bring this realization to loving consciousness. And I think probably the reality is that in our minds, we do perceive ourselves as separate from God in various situations. And maybe that's the point of growth. Then there's a whole section in this chapter about losing it. Regrettably, Christians have not protected this radical awareness of oneness with the divine. My friend, late friend, Verna Dozier, her name is sometimes said Dozier. I don't. Does anybody have any consciousness of Verna Dozier or Verna Dozier from years back? So she was an African-American mystic who lived in Washington, D.C., wrote a lot about lay ministry. That's how she's most identified. She wrote a really wonderful book, probably her the culmination of her thought and teaching is a book called The Dream of God. And Verna, and I think it's in that book, speaks of the conversion of Constantine as the second fall. And, you know, where we lost it. And, you know, the whole thing of Constantine painting the cross of Christ on the shields of his warriors, you know, so that they could go into the battle and win. So there's dualism for you. Getting away from the idea of Trinity as eternal flow, really what you were saying earlier, Pat, you know, this cycle of giving and receiving that is typical of the Trinity, you know, this constant flowing and outpouring, that in the way that Rome viewed the emperor as God, the Caesar, and basically transferring all of that emperor worship over to Jesus. So breaking Jesus out of the Trinity, having Jesus become an independent God in the mode of the Caesars, and then on the basis of that, justifying our tribe, group, nation. So very imperialistic, patriarchal, dualistic, and legitimating our religion, the name of our religion, Christianity, in the Roman Empire. Things were seen as either for us or against us, and we were either winners or losers, totally good, totally bad. Such a small self or ego, small self and its personal salvation always remained our overwhelming preoccupation up to now. Are you saved? You know, that kind of a concept. This is surely how our religion became so focused on obedience and conformity instead of on love in any practical or expanding sense. Without a shared and big story, we all retreat into private individualism for a bit of sanity and safety. And band together, obviously, to achieve those things. Then Richard's view of the sort of the prime example. He says the primary example of our lack of attention to the Christ mystery can be seen in the way we continue to pollute and ravage planet Earth, the very thing we all stand on and live from, science now appears to love and respect physicality more than most religion does. And of course, a lot of the, I mean, it's not an original thought at all to say that, you know, a lot of the mystics today, I mean, if you really want to hear a mystic, talk to a cosmologist, talk to a physicist, you'll have really the language and the view that has always been accorded the mystics. More, we can talk about that later. So then Richard talks about paddling out of the whirlpool with a very small paddle. We Christians did not take this world seriously, I'm afraid, because our notion of God or salvation didn't include or honor the physical universe, and now I'm afraid the world does not take us seriously. So this is really part of the collapse of the decorative church. So my sense is, and Marianne might disagree with me, my sense is that I think Richard thinks that the whirlpool, that something's going down that whirlpool. You know, something's going down there. Something may not go down there, but or something may come up out of it. Who knows? So to kind of parse that out, Jesus, so if we view Jesus as an independent, powerful God, you know, I always refer to that as the pocket Jesus, you know, the Jesus, my special friend Jesus, that is in my pocket where I can control him. But this idea of Jesus can hold together one group or religion, especially if we all have the same Jesus in our pocket. We can hold together with that, but then Christ can hold everything together. And then the thing that is interesting in all of this, especially with our minds that do kind of flip back and forth between unitive and dualistic, but to be reminded, in fact, Christ already does this. This is already happening. It's not just like if we can get our heads around it, thank goodness. Christ already does this. It is we who resist such wholeness as if we enjoy our arguments and our divisions into parts. And I'd have to add, too, that it's not always that we enjoy arguments and divisions into parts. Sometimes we do. I think sometimes it's just, you know, we're just our reflexes, our limitations, our vulnerability, our finiteness, you know, we just lapse into that somehow. And yet, you know, it really doesn't depend on us in that way because Christ is already doing this. So then, again, this verse from Colossians appears, there is only Christ. Christ is everything. Christ is in everything. This whole line is really interesting to me, and I think I think the next slide is, yeah, along this line. So think about this. Were Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons, Mayans and Babylonians, African and Asian civilizations, and the endless native peoples on all continents and isolated islands for millennia just throwaways or dress rehearsals for us? Is God really that ineffective, boring, and stingy? And so once again, this is not an elaborate argument. You know, this is Richard just saying, can we just go with common sense for a minute? Does the Almighty One operate from a scarcity model of love and forgiveness? Did the divinity need to wait for ethnic Orthodox, Roman Catholics, European Protestants, and American evangelicals to appear before the divine love affair could begin? He says, I cannot imagine. You know, and again, it's common sense. So here's my take on the common sense. And this is, I did this little research, which isn't research for anybody else but me, because most people, I think, already know this. But I thought, you know, I was like, somebody knows how many people have ever lived. Somebody knows this. This has to be a Googleable item, you know. You know, so, you know, pawing around the internet for a while. 100 billion humans, give or take, you know, probably a billion, you know, have lived on Earth. You know, so it's impossible for them to have been inconsequential. And also, like, what God are we talking about? Does the God we're talking about, does the sacred life we're talking about, does whatever we're talking about, does it have some some relatability, some ability to include the 7 billion who are living today. 7 billion people. You know, so, you know, if... Well, you get it. Future generations will have long discarded the notion of Christian salvation as a private evacuation plan that gets a few select humans into the next world. But a lot of Christianity hinges on that yet today. Surely God is at least as big and mysterious as what we now know the shape of the universe to be, a universe that is expanding at ever faster speeds, just like the evolution of consciousness that has been proceeding for centuries. Richard speaks of practical atheism as being the actual operative religion of most Western countries today, whether or not people have joined a church or not. Our small scarcity-based worldview is the real aberration here, and I believe it has largely contributed to the rise of atheism and the practical atheism that is the actual operative religion of most Western countries today. The God we've been presenting people with is just too small and too stingy for a big-hearted person to trust or to love back. And, you know, when you encounter someone who says, oh, I'm an atheist, or I'm an agnostic, I mean, those are terms, a lot of times I think they've been perceived as, oh, well, you're ungrateful, or you're mean, or you're whatever. Those are terms that people with common sense have been backed into, you know, because it's like either you believe in the stingy way that I believe, or if you don't, then you're an atheist. Like, I give that person that term. You know, it's not like they thought, oh, I think I'll, you know, grow up to be an atheist. You know, they just grew up to be bigger-hearted than being able to accept this tiny, again, the pocket Jesus. And they're saying, like, okay, well, if that's the way it is, then I must be this other thing. You know, so, anyhow. Great love and great suffering. So here he's shifting a bit to, so what's this? What is this? I mean, what's the experience of this? What's it feel like? How do we know it? Great love and great suffering. Which again, I mean, we're all, you know, whatever age we are, and I'm not assuming that we're all the same age, but we've lived enough to know, you know, that is how it comes. This is how revelation happens. This is how transcendence happens, because, you know, it's in great love and great suffering that we're pulled beyond our ego. So a few things here. Trinity, so this eternally giving one person to the next, endlessly outpouring and self-emptying. So both great love and great suffering constantly being experienced within the life of the Trinity. So, you know, when we're feeling put upon, it's like, oh, this is the shape of things. So twinned with Jesus, and if you think of the Jesus narrative, the story, you see the divine pattern of universal love and necessary suffering. So, you know, to the extent that Jesus was able to express this constant overarching reality, no surprise that, again, it's the same pattern. Then there is this concept of flow, which, you know, these things all change. And, oh yeah, actually on this slide at the bottom right-hand corner, there's no right word for God. And I think that's true. But if someone said, okay, well, you have to say something, I would probably use the word flow. You know, that there is this inside and outside of God and in and out of all of us, and, you know, that there's this movement. But again, rooted in, or, you know, in the model of the Trinity. And that it is beyond control. And I love this in the chapter. That beyond control is the nature of God. Who gives up control the most? God is constantly giving up control. not because God's a patsy or a victim, but because God is utterly free. Utterly free. And, you know, in my little tiny way, you know, I know when I give up control, what I experience is freedom. Not usually the impending disaster that made me seize control in the first place. Anyhow, so the proof that you're a Christian is that you can see Christ everywhere. For me, that's really a growing edge. You know, things that I had always seen in one way, well, suddenly, I mean, it's almost like a, can't think of, there's a term of light, something like luminescence or something like that. But where suddenly, you know, like I'm looking at the same thing and all of a sudden it's not, it doesn't appear the same. But again, God experience will usually feel like love or suffering, full reality, not a restriction to sacred or secular. And how long have we lived with that? You know, you should be listening to Christian music. You know, you should be listening. You know, is this a Christian business? You know, and that's out of my evangelical past, obviously. But there's always been this tendency to like divide up. You know, is this going to be religious music? It's like, what music is not spiritual? You know. Anyhow, God all in all. And then the very, very worthwhile, I think you probably all read, you know, from the, I think it's in the foreword even, of the book, Carol Houselander's Train Experience or Vision, you know, where, she, again, she's in a very, you know, routine kind of place, but then it, you know, just opened up for her. It's like Merton's vision on the corner of, what was it? What was that corner again? Fourth and Walnut, yeah. Was it Fourth? Was it Fourth and Walnut? What? Fourth and Walnut. Fourth and Walnut, right. There's a plaque there. Did you know that? Yeah. That's worth putting a plaque on. You know, usually things like that don't get plaques. God experience expands your seeing, never constricts it. See and love more and more. Heard it 1,000 times, the grain of wheat dies, bears much fruit. Transcend the small ego and include more. Transcend and include. And that's a concept that's articulated a lot by Ken Wilber. And I've heard, there's the way that Ken Wilber says it and there's the way that Richard says it. And which one's which, Marianne, do you remember? One's so one of them says it the other way around. So let's just think about it a second. So Ken Wilber says transcend and include. Richard says include and transcend. You know, that you can't decide later that you're going to include. You've got to include first. And then the transcendence comes in the process. But that's relatively recent. I bet you that was during the time that you were in Living School. Marianne was sent this past August, I get sent this July. There's a schedule conflict in August. But during the time that we've been in the Living School was when he flipped those around. Yeah, so he's growing. So to get specific, when you look at your dog in the face, for example, as I often looked at my black Labrador Venus, I truly believe you are seeing another incarnation of the divine presence, the Christ. When you look at any other person, a flower, a honeybee, a mountain, anything, you are seeing the incarnation of God's love for you and the universe you call home. Pause to focus on an incarnation of God's love apparent near you right now. You must risk it. And it is a risk, isn't it? We might lose our standards. And then I think probably all of you have seen the dedication of the book, right in the front of the book. I dedicate this book to my beloved 15-year-old black lab, Venus, whom I had to release to God while beginning to write this book. I'm surprised he could write the book after having done that. Anyhow, without any apology, lightweight theology, or fear of heresy, I can appropriately say that Venus was also Christ for me. That's what we're talking about. Anything that draws you out of yourself in a positive way for all practical purposes is operating as God for you at that moment. How else can the journey begin? How else are you drawn forward? Now, not by idle beliefs, but by inner aliveness. God needs something to seduce you out and beyond yourself. So God uses three things in particular: goodness, truth, and beauty. You cannot think your way into this kind of radiant, expansive seeing. You must be caught in a relationship of love and awe. And I suppose it's really at that point you must risk it. That's where the risk is. That if we're caught in a relationship of love and awe, we're vulnerable, right? We have, in the Living School, there's a lot that goes on. Lots to read, lots of lectures, lots of material to bring in. Though, I know in my first year, everybody who was being sent that year said, just pay attention to your practice, interestingly. So, while Marianne has read everything that was assigned, there's always this kind of, I hope I can get to this before I die. One of the other features is that we're all in these groups, called circle groups. And tell you the truth, after decades of doing stuff like that, it was the thing I was least happy about in anticipating the program. And I was super resistant when there's a day in the initial symposium where you meet your circle group, and it's in this huge ballroom at the Hotel Albuquerque, and I was slightly late walking in. I couldn't figure out what the heck was going on, how this thing was organized, and there were just kind of chairs everywhere. But there was no indication, like, you're supposed to go find your group. Well, there's no indication, like, well, how do you know? I mean, there's just all these people sitting in chairs. And no one was saying that in the center of all these circles of chairs, there was like a grocery bag with the number of whatever group that was, which I didn't see for a long time. So I was just kind of like losing patience rapidly, wandering around this, semi-dark ballroom. And so then I finally found our group, which was, of course, all the way on the other side of the ballroom and kind of in the middle. And by the time I sat down, whoever was introducing, this is how these groups are going to work and so on and so on. So I sat down, but, and there were these, seven other people sitting there. And, I was, at this point, I was just like fried. It was not my favorite idea of the whole thing. And just the whole introduction of it just was... And I just thought, this is dismal. This is the worst thing ever. And I was looking around at them, and I was thinking, I don't really want to know these people. I don't want to spend any time with these people. And, just the whole, that whole inner dialogue once the barn door is open and horses are running. And the guy who was talking, who I think was Tom Eberle, this guy, lovely, lovely man, but he just went on and on and on, all the particulars about how these groups are going to operate. And then finally he stopped, and one of the staff members from the center was convening our individual groups. Each group had somebody. This astounding woman named Gigi Ross, who's on the staff there, was convening our group. Anyhow, so then we turned and we faced each other. And in that second, that split second, I loved them. But, you know, it was, and what the experience was then and has been since, it's just, you know, this openness. And, you know, again, it's a different way of having the barn door open, you know, where, you know, it's just, you can come in, I might go out, but we can do this. But, you know, it has been somewhat costly. I mean, it has been costly, not just somewhat costly. But that's the risk. We are getting toward the end of this. Nothing to believe here at all. I love that. You don't have to believe any of this. You know, and, you know, it's just opposite what we've been told over and over. You must believe. You know, are you a believer? If you're not a believer, you should be a believer, blah, blah, blah. So for Paul and for ordinary mystics like you and me, ordinary mystics, the kind of seeing I'm describing is a relational and reciprocal experience in which we find God simultaneously in ourselves and in the outer world beyond ourselves. I doubt if there's any other way. All you can really do is return such presence with your own presence. Nothing to believe here at all. It's not a concept. It's not a head operation. It's you, me, us. Just learn to trust, draw forth from your own deepest experience, and you will know the Christ all day, every day. Here you are, before and after you ever go to any kind of religious service. This is the last slide. Fully accepted and fully accepting, church, temple, and mosque will start to make sense on whole new levels. And at the same time, church, temple, and mosque will become totally boring and unnecessary. I promise you both will be true. So include. Because you are already fully accepted and fully accepting. So, Richard with the book. So that's it for now. And we'll come back and talk.
Oh, I can't wait to come back. So, 20 minutes for the delicious snacks, all the visiting that you want to do, and we'll come back for more of this riveting, deeply engaging presentation from Randall. Thank you, Randall.
Thank you.